Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Is everyone awake and ready?
Awake and ready.
Wonderful. Well, it's been a long time since I've been to the Seattle service. I think last summer, perhaps, yeah. So let us pray together, O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peace. Bliss. Amen. Sent out a posting this morning, and I'd like to read from it. Excuse me. The sword is in Krishna's hand. The internal of a life is where life is really lived, for it is the creator of all activities. It may come as a surprise to many how much of an internal life we have, even as infants and small children. In fact, it is only through the conditioning by this world that mental reflection is sometimes blocked out in favor of living a life that is simply reactive to the conditions of this world. It is in the practice of meditation we come up against how much conditioning we have been through in this world. Even when in a safe meditation place, the mind races with preoccupations of this world. What happened yesterday? What will happen today? A careful recall of things that happened years ago, or perhaps lifetimes ago. What will happen years from now? All these thoughts can fill your mind when your whole intention is to become still in the here and now. In these past weeks, I have been absorbing what doctors have been telling me, what different books and people are saying, taking it all in and digesting it for possible future action. In addition, I have been witness to how this body and mind are reacting to all this information. When I focus on the condition of the body in the here and now, I feel fine. I know that it can take some months for anemia to completely right itself, but I can walk up hills and run on my rebounder each day with a building endurance that replicates times of past good health. My incision is healing very nicely and there are no tumors. Life is good. In the midst of all this is what doctors tell me is a looming problem, what an oncologist called the sword of Damocles. Now in the story, the sword of Damocles is held by a hair and hangs over the head of the king. It may give way at any moment. The other day, I was running on the rebounder, listening to a song about Krishna, and looking at a beautiful picture I have of the Master. Suddenly, a mental image came to me of the sword of Damocles above me, and instead of hanging by a hair, it was held by the smiling Krishna. How lovely is that? The reality is that facts are not always truth. The fact is there's a statistical probability of new tumors growing. The truth is, no one knows for sure. Another truth is that the mind is a powerful player in health, hope, faith, love, and trust all enhance the health of the body. Also, there are healthy habits of eating and exercise that helps create an inhospitable body, what one researcher calls the terrain for cancer cells. So first of all, I choose God. Smiling Krishna is in charge of the sword. I choose empowerment of choice for healthy habits. I choose love, and I choose to continue to learn, grow, serve, and to be happy. There are many examples of people who live long lives unfulfilled and unhappy. There are other examples of those who have had shorter lives, but were quite the opposite. In fact, they changed the world in infinitely better ways. The lives of Jesus, Adi Shankaracharya, St. Francis, Swami Ramatirtha, the little flower, St. Teresa, and Swami Vivekananda may have been short, but oh, what lives they lived. The sword is in Krishna's hand, and while I'm here, I will sing and dance and serve and be in joy of God all the days of my life. And who knows, God may not be done with me yet. I have the picture of Krishna dancing on the heads of the snake. That comes from Srimad Bhagavatam. I'd like to read from this lovely book, Krishna, by Baba Bharati, that was published in 1904. In those days when love was predominant and held no place for that which overcame and betrayed that which could not hold away, because love is strong and active, then doth evil become feeble and weak and slinketh away into darkness and deep places where the light of love cannot reach it to reveal its blackness into the light of the sky. In the river on whose banks Krishna, Rama, and the cowherd boys often sat and sang the deeds of their hero, there dwelt a huge serpent monster with 1,000 hoods who by the venom of his hideous body did permeate the water of the lake with deadly poison and filled the air of the vicinity with a pestilent atmosphere that was deadly in its influence. Krishna one day led the boys and cows to this pool, and they, being athirst, drank of the deadly water that lay still and without a ripple, for evil is ever inviting in its outward calm. But lo, in an instant, the 1,000-headed monster lifted its hoods, and the deadly poison having done its ghastly work, the boys and the cows lay on the bank lifeless and motionless, and they fell at the feet of Krishna. With a glance of life-giving love cast upon the dead ones, Krishna walked to a tree that was close by, while the boys, alive again, in amazement and wonder, gazed at each other, forgetting in the joy of the love in the look that Krishna had cast upon them the moment before. On reaching the top of the tree, Krishna stood for an instant and gazed at the boys, his world, and the serpent, and a light as a molten gold seemed to come from that body, more lovely than the sun to look upon. Thus it was for a moment, then turned into the deadly pool he plunged, while the 1,000-headed heads of the serpent darted their venomous tongues and struck the boys till the boys fell unconscious, and the cows groaned in pain, and men and women with eyes bulging with fear and tearing their hair almost swooned at the sight of the boy who was God. Crushed in the poisonous embrace of the monster, yet even as stricken with horror, they gazed. Krishna, a glance like light on them, cast, and breaking away from the grasp of the monster, he lightly sprang on the hood of the head and danced like the stars upon his hoods, till one by one they were laid, and vomiting blood that was thick and black, defeated and broken, the monster sank beneath the waves. And with a bound, Krishna stood in the midst of his friends, who knelt at his feet. Then they drew him near within their arms in the madness of joy at his safety. Oh, grand was the sight of love, crushing out hate from the land. And the gods sang and shouted and crowded together to see sin conquered and virtue grow strong. Yashoda and Nanda, with the gopas and gopis, maddened with delight, took Krishna home while the heavens opened and scattered flowers to carpet his path. And forever the lake was free from the venom the serpent had cast, and the nearby atmosphere purified from the pestilent influence that hovered about there. For the monster at Krishna's command had departed and sought no more to injure the land. But so great was the happiness that overflowed in the heart of all in leading the boy triumphant through the forest that they tarried a while in the glow of the moon in their joy to behold the beauty that filled the night. But far in a distance, a light was seen that spread wider and broader in glow, and higher its flame leapt. And every second nearer and nearer it came, like a living sheet of fire. And so it was, a castor plantation, a burning world, had become, and quickly surrounded the merrymakers, who in their midst, the joy of their hour, they cried in fright, O Krishna, O thou child, or God, whatever thou art, protect us from this death in the roaring flame. We care not for our lives, O Krishna, for thou art thine by our love for thee. But oh, the anguish the parting would mean to die and not see thee, thy face again. O thou who by thy strength dost slay the asuras and drive from the land the serpent all-powerful, save us from this, the parting with thee and thy loved companion Rama, he that is most like thee. O most lovely one, deliver us, we pray. Light as a leaf in the wind, the boy bounded to meet the coming flames. For a moment he stood in the seething sea of fire and lifted his hand on high, and lo, the fire was not, but the flames were seen to enter his mouth. And again, with dancing and singing praise to the boy, they made for his home with joy and delight. There are so many stories of Krishna as he went through his boyhood. He was surrounded all the time, left and right, with all sorts of demons, all sorts of people who came to kill him. And read in one light, he had a difficult childhood. But in the way that the story is told, he always overcomes the evil. He is never deluded by darkness. It is rare, even in the life of avatars, that there is one who never suffers any delusion of separation at all. Even Rama and Jesus and many of the other great avatars, the Buddha, they went through times of great difficulty and felt sadness, separation, delusion even. However, they always came out all right. But Krishna stands alone in the sense that he never gave in to any kind of delusion at all. I'd like to also read from The Science of Religion by Paramahansa Yogananda. This is a wonderful book if you've never read it. And in it, he lays out the logic for why we should seek God. And he writes, our ordinary conception of God is that he is superhuman, infinite, omnipresent, omniscient, and the like. In this general conception, there are many variations. Some call God personal, some impersonal, and so forth. The point emphasized in this book is that whatever conception we have of God, if it does not influence our daily conduct, if everyday life does not find an inspiration from it, and that if it is not found universally necessary, then that conception is useless. If God is not conceived in such a way that we cannot do without him. In that, in the satisfaction of want, in our dealings with people, in earning money, in reading a book, in passing an examination, in doing the most trifling or the highest duties, then it is plain that we have not felt any connection between God and life. God may be infinite, omnipresent, omniscient, personal, and merciful, but these conceptions are not sufficiently compelling to make us try to know him. We may as well do without him. He may be infinite, omnipresent, and so forth, but we have no immediate and practical use for those conceptions in our busy, rushing lives. We fall back on those conceptions only when we seek to justify in philosophical or poetic writings, in art or in idealistic talks, the finite craving for something beyond, when we, with all of our vaunted knowledge, are at a loss to explain some of the most common phenomena of the universe, or when we get stranded in the vicissitudes of the world. We pray to the ever-merciful when we get stuck. We pray to the ever-merciful when we get stuck, as the Eastern maxim has it. Otherwise, we seem to get along all right in our workaday world without him. These stereotype conceptions appear to be the safety valves of our pent-up human thought. They explain him, but do not make us seek him. They lack motive power. We are not necessarily seeking God when we call him infinite, omnipresent, all-merciful, and so forth. These conceptions satisfy the intellect, but do not soothe the soul. Isn't that wonderful? These conceptions satisfy the intellect, but do not soothe the soul. If respected and cherished in our hearts, they may broaden us to a certain extent, may make us moral and resigned toward him, but they do not make God our own. They are not intimate enough. They place him aloof from everyday concerns of the world. These conceptions savor of outlandishness when we are on the street, in a factory, behind a counter, or in an office, not because we are not really dead to God and religion, but because we lack a proper conception of them, a conception that can be interwoven with the fabric of daily life. I'll read that again because I just think it's tremendous. These conceptions savor of outlandishness when we are on the street, in a factory, behind a counter, in an office, not because we are really dead to God and religion, but because we lack a proper conception of them, a conception that can be interwoven with the fabric of daily life. When we conceive of God, what we conceive of God should be of daily, nay, hourly guidance to us. The very conception of God should stir us to seek him in the midst of our daily lives. This is what we mean by a pragmatic and compelling conception of God. We should take religion and God out of the sphere of belief into that of daily life. If we do not emphasize the necessity of God in every aspect of our lives and the need of religion in every minute of our existence, then God and religion drop out of our intimate daily consideration and become only a one-day-in-a-week affair. In the next chapter, I'll stop there. And of course, Master, being Master, is absolutely correct in what he says here. We need to be able to put God into the everyday fabric of our life. This is absolutely necessary. And if we don't conceive of God in this way, if we don't see him as something that is within us, deep within us, that we could not have breath, we could not have thought, we could not have life if it were not for God. We like to think of ourselves as independent beings, And we set about proving that by doing what we choose to do without any reference to any divine being. And therefore we see God as something as dispensable. But when we come to realize that in this world there is no lasting happiness, we may get little bits and pieces here and there. Life may run pretty smoothly for us at times. But the truth is that every happiness we find in this world also has some difficulty that follows along with it. There is no exceptions to this. And even if you were to live the most perfect life this world ever had to offer, when you come to the end of it, you have to leave it all behind as you enter into that unknown journey into who knows what at the time of death. If you have not sought out anything else, then perhaps in your conception, all things cease to exist at the point of death. And yet, we seem to think that that is not really very fulfilling for us. We like to think of an afterlife. We like to think that there is something more that comes. But unless we really get into the laboratory of our own being, really investigate it, it's just simply a thought. Perhaps it's a fanciful conception that we have. I remember asking my mother when I was young that when I get into heaven, do I get all the candy that I'd like to eat? And my mother, being my mother, said, well, I suppose so. You know, she's very accommodating and wanting me to be happy when I get there. So we have this, you might call, anthropomorphized view of what heaven is, and perhaps it's just simply an extension of this world, only there's no wars, there's no blights, there's no rainy days if you don't want them, and so on. It's a perfect idealized life. And yet that, too, is a very narrow conception. You think of this vast universe that we live in. You think of the galaxies, of the power, the intelligence that has gone into the creation of this whole universe. And this is but one tiny universe in a constellation of many, many universes. And above that rises the tremendous astral realms. And all of the variety, all of the color, all of the life that is contained in that. And then you go beyond that, and then there is the almost infinite causal realms that go beyond that. These are tremendous conceptions. And when you imagine them, you begin to get a vague concept of what God is, how big God is, how powerful, how intelligent. And yet the mind can never conceive completely of that intelligence, of that power, of that infinite expanse. It is only through God experience that you can really get a taste, really get a flavor for what that is. And even then, as you merge into oneness with God, you have God experience, and you experience different aspects of Him. But can you ever know Him? And as long as you have any circumference to your being at all, you cannot, because God is infinite. These are fine, high, mighty words, as Master points out. But unless we make that conception something that is absolutely necessary for our daily lives, then we have not come very far at all, even if we proclaim we have a belief and faith in a higher being, in a God, in a beneficent universe, however you tend to consider it. So what makes God compelling on a day-to-day basis? As I said, we have pleasure, but we also have pain. We have fulfillment, but we also have things taken away from us. We have loving relationships, but ultimately, those people and we ourselves leave this world. We die. And so, we realize that we are standing on shaky ground, and as a result of that, there is a kind of nervousness, a kind of anxiety, a kind of unsettledness, whether we recognize it or not. Because we know every time that we perhaps see a dead person or read about somebody we know who has died or somebody that we cared about as a public figure has died, we feel that loss. We feel that separation. We can't go there with them. And so we know that there is more to life, that there is a lasting happiness. Somehow we intuitively perceive that, even if we don't experience it. And so when we get into really living a spiritual life, we make that connection with God. First, it may be through meditation, or we may be given through grace a wonderful uplifting experience. And we realize that there is a life and intelligence, a divine being that is beyond creation, that is beyond having a beginning and an end, an alpha and omega, and it has gone far, far beyond that. We sense it, we feel it, we intuit it, and perhaps we have, to a certain extent, come into the realization of that. And that, we realize, gives us a firm foundation, a rock to stand upon. When Jesus was asking the disciples, "Who am I?" And it was Peter who came forward and said, "You are the Christed one. You are the anointed one. You are the Son of God." And Jesus said, "No man has told you this, but you have received this from God directly. And I will change your name now from Simon to Peter," Peter meaning the rock. "And it is upon this rock that I will build my church." Now, human beings, because they tend to think in material human ways, have oftentimes put Peter up on a pedestal then. And he is the one who was to carry on the tradition because of what the Christ had said. But it has a deep inner meaning as well. Peter represents that realization of truth that comes from direct perception, not through belief. But because he had gone within the laboratory of his own being and had realized what it was that he was saying in that moment to the Christ. And it is upon this rock of realization that the Christ builds his church. It is not through simple belief. It is not through going to church once or twice a week or however often. It is through that direct perception. And when we have that direct perception, that is the rock, that is the firm foundation, and it can be upon nothing else. So we go within the laboratory of our own beings, as Peter did. We go beyond the simple conceptions and ideas and even faith. We seek out something greater, something higher, something that we can stand upon and never gives way beneath us. This is the essence of leading a spiritual life. And if we are not seeking out that kind of universal vision in which we have that experience that takes us beyond ourselves, so to speak. Now, in one sense, we can't go beyond ourselves, but we step from the confines of our little self with a small s, and we step into the expanded sense of self with a capital S. The capital S represents our great self, our spiritual self, our divine being. And that divine being and God are not one. In the East, they call it the Atman. The Atman is the soul. And when you sense that soul in yourself, you sense your individuality, but it is a greater, expanded individuality. You feel yourself as having always existed. When you're in a deep state of meditation, you'll come to that state where you know that you have always been and you will always be. Nothing, there is no creation, there is no beginning and no end. And this is a tremendous experience to come to. And that experience takes you into the Paramatman, or the Supreme Self, the God Self within you. It takes you beyond the soul knowledge of individuality and takes you into the universal self. It's really impossible to describe that state, but it is as if the boundaries that define you all begin to dissolve. And of course you think, well, if there are no boundaries to define me, then who am I? And that's exactly the right question to ask. It can also be terrifying because we don't know what's on the other side of that question. Perhaps we're nothing. Perhaps it is something that's unpalatable, that we don't care for, that we don't like. Our imagination fills in the blanks. And whatever fear we may have entertained around God or infinity or any of those kinds of notions rises up. And we have to encounter it and go beyond it. When we go beyond it, those definitions that have defined us for a very, very long time dissolve, we melt, we merge into a divine ocean of consciousness. And we realize that none of our fears are fulfilled. Quite the opposite. We feel fulfilled. We feel satisfied. And we feel that we have truly and totally arrived at home. This is the tremendous experience that comes to us as we merge into that infinite field of consciousness. And it is a tremendous defining moment in the existence of a soul. And it frees you. Now, some people may have glimpses into this state, but that is not the whole thing. It's not until we are able to bring that experience back with us, so to speak, and live in this world, and every moment then is informed by that divine essence that we have discovered within ourselves. We no longer go in and out of the temple of our true being. We reside there always, and yet, if it be divine will, we express ourselves in the human sense. However, as said earlier, it has this divine quality about it. You never lose sight of the fact of who and what you are in your divine self, even as you express yourself in the human. So Mother was able to say, I am totally human and divine. Both are true. Now, many times when we're on the upward ascent, we see that this human being that we are is interfering with our ability to go all the way to God. It's our human fears, or it's human attachments, it's our human preoccupations that keep us from entering into that divine consciousness. And so we might imagine that for a realized being, they no longer express themselves through their humanity. And in a sense, you can say that the humanness in them has died. That is the crucifixion of the Christ upon your own cross. It is the human cross. It is that cross when you stand upright and with your arms outstretched. That is you. That is his human self. And your spine, when you're standing upright, is ascendant. It's moving upwards, and your arms outstretched represent the horizontal world, and it is the limitations of this world. And so as the ascending seed comes up the spine at the heart center, it meets there this horizontal force, and it's a force of resistance. Everything that you've hugged to your bosom in a human sense all comes to the fore. And it is at this time that you enter into the mystical crucifixion. And it is a real thing that you have to go through. You meet those forces, and when you keep your mind upon God alone, you are enabled to transform and go beyond that heart center. The heart center is opened, completely released. It's painful when it happens. It's like creaking old door that doesn't have any WD-40 to put on it. It's just difficult, and it's painful in its opening. But when it opens, the flood of divine love comes through you, a love that goes beyond human conception, a divine love that loves all creation equally. It's impersonal in that sense, not in the sense that it's cold and above everything, but in the sense that you don't distinguish between people, objects, things. It flows through you completely and totally and has no limitation whatsoever. And then you go into the fifth center, and that is the place of truth and speech. And there you have to face all those things that you have projected out from you, spoken out, and those places where you have defied the truth and not embraced it. Now, we all have lives that we have lived that we'd prefer not be brought out into the open. And we prefer other people not to know about it. But you know that God has been with you from the very beginning, and He knows every part of you. And there is no place to feel shame. There is no place to feel fear at the feet of God. In fact, it is God who will help us to transcend and overcome all that that we have done wrongly down through time. And so when you come to that place, you come to all those temptations. And when you overcome that, then you are freed from the throat center. And there you can speak the truth. And you can do it without fear. You can do it without limitation. At that point, you only abide in truth. There is nothing else that you would rather have. And if something represents untruth, you get rid of it as quickly as you can. And you rise up and you rise into the realm of the mental. And that is up in the brain. It is the causal realm. And here it is a very subtle realm. You realize that every thought that you have has creative power. And that you never have a moment when that is not recorded, when it does not have a result that goes out from you and comes back to you. So in this realm of thought, you attune every thought that you have to the realm of the divine. You put your whole attention on God. And every thought that runs counter to that will come up to you. And it's a terrific battle, but it's one that you have to win. Now, how do you go about making every thought a God thought? First of all, chanting God's name or meditating upon a holy mantra such as Hong Sa are wonderful ways to sow that thought into everything that you do and say and everything that you feel. Your heart is open to God now, because you have opened that center and you feel that divine love flowing through you. And that takes your thoughts. It gives power and flight to your thoughts, lifting you up higher. You realize that the state of bhakti, that divine love within you, that is the power that takes you all the way into God consciousness. And so with thought soaring on the wings of love, with a divine love that seeks out God only, every thought tuned to the thought of God, you are completely and totally transformed. Every word that you speak comes from God. And if you misspeak in any kind of way at all, it causes you some pain, and you immediately correct it. Now all three of these centers are working in perfect harmony and tune with the divine consciousness. And you feel it, you experience it, and it is transforming you. And as that transformation becomes complete, you finish the mystical crucifixion. You come into your own. You come into that total and complete stillness that is God. You go beyond the things of time and space. You go beyond any limitations whatsoever. Now you still exist. There is still the witness that is inside of you. But the witness merges into that infinite divine self. You spread out into eternal consciousness. And you become that eternal consciousness. You merge into that light. And you become that light. You merge into everything that is God. And you become that. Then you may say, I am that I am, because you and what God is not different then. Now this no way enhances the ego, because the ego is dead. The ego is no longer functioning at this point. You could not enter into this realm of being and still have the ego there. In the story of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna for a brief time is lifted up into that state of consciousness. But because he had not gone through the complete purification, it was a state of grace that lifted him up, but he could not reside there permanently. So at a point he became terrified, and he asked Krishna to resume his beloved form that he was comfortable with. He didn't want to yet merge into that infinite divine consciousness. It really takes strength, spiritual strength, tremendous strength, in order to enter into that state and remain in it, so that a thought doesn't come along. We all have that experience in meditation. You're doing pretty well in meditation, you're feeling God. Suddenly a thought comes to you, you remember something that you need to do. Perhaps it's some fear, something that happened long ago, or you're thinking may happen into the future. And you're pulled out of that high state of consciousness that you've been in. This is your battlefield. And this is the battlefield that Arjuna was on with Krishna. And so he asked Krishna to take on the beloved form. He wasn't ready yet in order to enter into that divine consciousness. And Krishna even said it's rare for a human being to have a glimpse of that state of consciousness, but he gave it to Arjuna because he was much beloved and Arjuna had asked for it. So God gives us that grace. Sometimes we're seeking it out. Sometimes it just comes to us. Sometimes it really inspires us to start out on the spiritual path where before we hadn't much of an interest in it. Because God had held out the carrot. He had showed us what is possible. And as a result of that, we never look back. We continue on until we attain permanently that state of consciousness. This is not just a fairy tale. It's not just somebody else's life. This is your life. You have that potential residing within you. And this is the most tremendous potential possibility that we can possibly entertain. There's nothing that's greater. No position in this world, no amount of wealth, no nothing can come close to comparing with what it is like when you enter into this divine state of being, and to know that it is so close. I know that at times it feels so far away, but that's not the truth. In the picturesque language of Jesus, that's the devil who's tempting you, who's trying to draw you away, making you think that this infinite consciousness is far away, but it is not. It dwells right within you. It is like a tiny seed that you have. I wanted to read from Swami Ramatirtha. He was a great saint who lived in India, and he actually came to the West for a short time and gave some talks. And he was a great inspiration for both Master and for Papa Ram Dass. He's really tremendous. And so he's giving a talk here in the West, and Swami Ramatirtha says, sometimes the lectures and the orations will produce an instantaneous effect. They are like mere candy, nothing abiding in them, nothing lasting in them. Here's something which will produce the most abiding and the most lasting influence on you. In universities and colleges, people listen hour after hour to the lectures of the instructors and professors. In the universities, the professors do not manifest any oratorical ability or observance of any rhetorical rules. The professors usually lecture to their audiences slowly, calmly, hesitantly, but the students have to take up every word that drops from their lips, whether the professor has a gift of producing an instantaneous effect or not. The students have to take up every word that drops from his lips. So, and like Papa, after him, Rama Tirtha refers to himself as Rama. So Rama says to the world today, the world must listen to his words, just in the same spirit in which the college students listen to the words of their professors. You may say these words are presumptuous, but yes, the time is coming when the, and he pauses for some time, and there's a note here. When Rama came, perfectly silent, was lost in thought that the whole world would of necessity one day drink deep from the fountain of spiritual life, and that the goal he was pointing out would be the destination of man. The infinite in the finite is the proposition for tonight's discussion. It is very hard to popularize philosophy. It is very hard indeed to popularize knowledge. But Socrates says, and the words of Socrates are perfectly right, knowledge is virtue. It is this idea that will ultimately govern mankind. It is knowledge that governs mankind. It is knowledge that transforms itself into action. People want ready-made action. Ready-made action will not abide. Rama is bringing to you knowledge which will convert yourself into infinite power of action. It is hard to popularize it. We will do our best to make this difficult and obtuse problem as easy as possible. We will begin with the minutest thing you can conceive of in this world. The minutest thing that you usually see in this world, say, a poppy seed. Or you might take the mustard seed, or any other seed you please, some small seed. Very small it is. Hold it before you on the palm. What is the seed? Is it the seed that you see before you? Or that you smell, or that you weigh, or that you touch? Is it the seed, that tiny something? Or is the seed something else? Let us examine. Sow this seed in the earth, underground. It is very short time. The seed germinates into a beautiful plant, a sprouting plant. And out of this first original seed, we get thousands of seeds again in due time. Sow these thousands of other seeds, and we will obtain millions of seeds of the same sort. Sow these millions of seeds again, and we get quadrillions of seeds of the same sort. What does this phenomenon imply? The original seed, the first seed which we began, where is that seed now? That perished in the ground. That died in the ground. That is not to be seen anywhere. But out of the original seed, we have got today quadrillions and quintillions of seeds of the same sort. What an infinite potentiality, what an infinite power, what an infinite capability concealed or hidden or latent in the primitive original seed with which we began. Isn't that wonderful? And it's absolutely true. And so we start out with something that seems sometimes very small, very ordinary. But if we water it with love, if we fertilize it with attention, that seed will grow. And it can grow into a great tree. And that tree itself can propagate many, many seeds as well. It's really tremendous when you think about it. What is in that seed? You look at it on the surface, it doesn't look like much. But look at what it can do. It can propagate a crop all over this world. And so it is with our thoughts. So it is even more with the spirit that is within us. It starts out as a small thing, perhaps. It seems tenuous. It seems unsure and uncertain. But we water it with our attention. We fertilize it with our love, and it grows, and it grows, and it turns into a great tree, a great plant, and out of that many seeds are cast about, and other seeds, other plants, can begin to germinate and grow up as well. You can change this world. Look at the life of Jesus. Look at the life of Adi Shankaracharya. Look at the lives of so many of the great saints, and many of them in the beginning. For the first few hundred years with Jesus' teachings, it didn't look like much. It took a while for it to germinate. It took a while for it to really take root and to grow strong. And now it has grown all over this world. And so it is with many of the great teachers. And so you can't judge a thing just on the surface. You have to see what effect it has on this world, what effect it has within you. You're meditating. You're doing your spiritual practice. Perhaps you feel like you're not getting anywhere. Now, in one sense, this can spur you on to greater activity. All right, I'm going to dig in more. I'm going to do harder. But you also understand there is just simply a germination time. And that seed that is sown deep within you when you're initiated into this wonderful path, it will one day take root. It will one day grow into this tremendous plant. And it will also provide shade for this world, for weary souls. It will provide nesting areas for birds. They are like heavenly thoughts that come and rest in the tree of your spine, the tree of your being. And then you will cast seeds that will go out and that can spread all over this world. Now, you don't do it for your own sake. In that sense, you will be long gone. But you do it out of compassion and love for this world, because you realize that what you've discovered within yourself is the most precious seed ever conceived of, and that it needs to be spent, because seeds need to go out in order to propagate. There are some seeds that existed in the tombs in Egypt for thousands and thousands of years because it was kept in the dark and in the cool. And it was discovered just in the last century, and those seeds were brought out. And you know what? They actually produced new crops. And they were able to grow from those seeds that have been in there for so many thousands of years. Isn't that a wonderful thing? So you never know where your seeds will go, you see. It can get lodged with somebody, and maybe it'll reside there for lifetimes. And then one day, it'll take root, and it'll grow into a tremendous tree of God. So you never know. Why do you live this life? Because it gives you joy. It gives you spontaneous joy as God expresses himself through you. That joy weaves itself in throughout your day. There is no activity, there is nothing that you do that is separate from it. It continues to grow in you and weave itself into your life. And it is wonderful, and it is beautiful. And when you have it, you wouldn't trade it for anything else, not anything else in this world. And so that is why God is necessary, because only God can sow that kind of a seed and have that kind of production and that kind of infinite results. And it will not just be with you in this lifetime, but it will follow you into whatever life God takes you to into next. And you'll continue to unfold, you'll continue to manifest those godly virtues, because they are part and parcel of your being. This is a tremendous vision, a universal vision, and it is a necessity for all mankind if they really want happiness, lasting happiness, true happiness. Nothing else can offer it. Nothing else can give it. So let us resolve within ourselves to make a steady and constant practice of keeping our mind on God, loving God, serving God, and sharing that light with one and all. It doesn't have to come through your words, but it comes through your actions. And you may walk into a room, and you may not know a person in that room, and your light spreads out from your heart, and you embrace every person in that room. And perhaps they don't know where it came from, but suddenly somebody will feel more calm. They'll feel more peaceful. They'll feel a bit of upliftment. They'll feel some encouragement where they had none before. It changes this world, believe me. And you can be the author, you and God within you, can be the origin, the source of a tremendous change in this world. If you would but keep your mind upon God and serve Him in all whom you meet. So let us have our closing prayer. O Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty,
of Thy glorious presence,
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet,
and surrender myself to Thee.
I feel Thy perfection,
surging in every cell
of this grand and glorious body.
It comes as perfect health,
perfect attunement with Thee,
perfection in all ways.
And I am that,
and Thou art me,
and we are always one. To the great light within you. I've asked Kate, who's just recently returned back from Anandashram, to say a few words about her experiences and her time there, so Kate, if you would come up front here. Yes.
Yes, I got back on Wednesday and had an absolutely wonderful time this time. From the moment we arrived to the moment I left, having a lovely group of people who came to see me off, all singing Ram Nam, and me crying, and it was just a really wonderful time in many, many ways. There's not only the love that you feel from all the people that I've known through the years, and it's always interesting to see how God brings them back. People that aren't necessarily there all the time, but they manage to show up during the time I'm there. Just about all of the ones that I'm close to. But that's a love we find here in this group, and we find some other places, and that's certainly an extraordinary part of Anandashram, but not the only reason to go, of course. And this time I'd have to say the main thing, or the main theme, seemed to be, it's a little hard to explain maybe if you haven't been there, but maybe not. The founder of Anandashram, Swami Ram Dass, Mataji began to call him Papa, as his daughter had called him. But they see him both as that person, that saint, and then as the universal God, the Pop, so Lord of the Universe, Papa, they'll call him. And seeing that personalized form of God in their guru. and him as the universal infinite being. So that was what I was seeing Papa as this time. So Papa was taking on, I think in the past, certainly I've always been attracted to Papa. Papa as the saint, as the guru, as not my personal guru, but as that wonderful saint I've always been attracted to, and then was very focused on Swami Satchidananda when I've been there before. But this time Papa certainly took on that Lord of the Universe Papa. And I can't really express to you just the immensity of that feeling of somehow recognizing that. And the one day that it really hit me was on Mother's Mahasamadhi Day, and the ashram really pulled out the stops in letting me, letting all of us celebrate Mother. I asked, as I had in the past, saying, can we have her picture in the Bhajan Hall? And Swami Muktananda had gone. He was in seclusion in Sri Lanka. But I asked Swami Chandrananda and Sri Krishna and Swami Sannyasananda, who were kind of in charge, the three of them, when he left. And all of them said, yes, of course. And so we planned to have her picture in there between Papa and Mataji. And then I said, can we do something for the satsang period, which we had done in the past? And it had to be arranged on a different day than her Mahasamadhi day, because on Sundays they do continuous Ram Nam. They don't do any other programs. They still have the Bhajan Hall going, but they don't do the reading and they don't do other things. And everybody's supposed to put extra effort into doing the Ram Nam. So we decided to do it on the Friday because there was going to be a visiting saint. And so we did that, and we had Mother's picture from the canteen there, sitting in a chair. She was propped up in the chair, and everybody said they really felt Mother's presence there, everybody that attended. And then we printed those cards, and we got the office manager helped me with it, and we got a quote from the printer. And then when they arrived back, I was there and picking them up, and I said, so how much was it to pay them? And Sri Krishna, that lovely man you just heard on the chants, he said, oh, no, the ashram will pay for this. He said, this is ashram business. She all belongs to us. So he wouldn't take the money for it. But then we got, I ordered some special flowers that sat in front of her, and they put a garland around her, and they asked me to do the light the arati that day, and then they asked me to do the Ram Nam, and then I ordered prasad that I was giving out at lunchtime. I was very, very busy that day. I was just one thing after another. But I was sitting in the Bhajan Hall before, I should back up a little bit. I was passing out the cards. I had passed them out at the satsang, so I was passing them out after the flower offering in the morning too. So I was sitting on a stoop, and there's this man from the U.S. who's kind of a longtime devotee there, but he kind of strikes me as a little bit sardonic and a little bit sarcastic, and I didn't really have a real glimpse into his spiritual side at all. But he comes out of the Bhajan Hall that day and said to me, this is the most amazing place to see Mother there, to see Mother in there, to see how universal this place is. And there's no place like this, he says, and he starts to cry. And somehow or other, that message became the seed for me. And so I was sitting later in the Bhajan Hall, getting ready to do the arati, and just that immense gratitude to Papa, thinking of, here's Mother, and she's here, and there's this saint from another, or a leader of another organization, and there's this kind of weird Swami from Russia, who knows what kind of thing he's into, and he's sitting over there, and just this amazing inclusiveness about this place. And so that That plus that sense of Papa as the Lord of the universe. It was an extremely expansive experience for me. And so I was sitting there, Mother's right in front of me, and then this visiting Swami over here. And I had come out to record a Ram Nam that I liked, so I was sitting right in the middle of the room, and the tears were coming down, and I thought, oh, if I leave, I'm just going to be more obvious, so I'll just kind of sit here like this. But it was a very expansive experience for me, and it all had to do with that seeing Papa and of course, Mother, and all the rest, just in that expanded Purushottama, they call it the Purushottama aspect of God and the Guru. So that was a really wonderful experience. And and then I have to admit to just being, you know, sometimes people say, well, they go and it's quite difficult for them, and maybe it's because I've been a number of times, but I just feel like I've been taken by the hand and taken there. I mean, Papa even arranged business class seats for us. You know, we are just taken care of in so many ways, like little spoiled children. And so I can't really say, is it difficult for me? No, nothing was really difficult. Everything was really wonderful. And right down to the fact that something that kind of had become a difficulty in the last time I was there, and I kind of didn't realize how much it had impacted me until David brought me up short about it after I came back and said, and it was all around being judgmental. And that was something that I was kind of thinking about a lot this time, being judgmental. And so there's the group of people that come and visit the ashram who I have been judgmental about in the past. And it turns out they were coming back. And I thought, okay, Kate, this is custom made for you here. I can tell this is something that you need to pass the test for this time. So I'm thinking about how I cannot let this ruin my time there this time like it did the last time. And then Swami Chandrananda reads from Mataji that day. And Mataji talked about when she was doing her sadhana that anybody that she was to think a bad thought about or judgmental thought about, that she was determined that she would go, and if the person was taking a bath, that she would drink the dirty water coming out of the bath drain. So I put that into my mind, thought, okay, you don't want to drink any dirty water. So watch those thoughts around these people. And God's brought them here for you to pass this test this time. So I really watched myself. And it didn't mean I had to, that they all had to end up being my best friend. But I was tried to be very, very respectfully pronoun and see that, again, isn't this amazing place, this ashram, that they can bring people who aren't necessarily aligned with everything that they do and that they believe, and yet welcome them in and try to see God in them and probably lifting them up at the same time. Who am I to say that they don't belong there and that they're not good enough for the ashram, you know, when they are willing to accept them and take them in there. And so that was a good lesson. And hopefully I passed the test. I didn't drink any dirty water. So, but that shows Mataji's one-pointedness and her what she would do in order to gain her own realization. Mm-hmm. So we're very blessed to be able to go back again, everybody, as soon as I arrived. How is David? How is David? And they are all very, very concerned, and universally, everybody who knew him, and asking how David was. And
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome.
That's
very welcome.
Lovely.
It's nice to be back with all of you. Mm-hmm. It was hard to leave, but it was. I said you could tell. I said to somebody that I'm still within the poles of opposites, the pairs of opposites, because I get up in the morning and think I never want to leave. in the lovely cool of the day. And by the time it gets about 5 o'clock, I think, okay, it's time to go home. So I said, I'm still having to face these pair of opposites.
Yeah.
But that's how it was. And we have prasad, lots of prasad. Mm. I was leaving, and I had the full suitcase, and people had given me things to bring home to David. And then Swami said, I go for prasad. And Larry said to me, I'm going to take the prasad for the group because I know that you're going to be kind of overweight. And so I go to Swami Sannyasana to get my prasad, hoping for a little bag, yeah. Right, because my suitcase is full. He has 4 bags like this. And I said, oh, Swamiji, I thought Larry took it all back. He says, well, Swami Muktananda, I was on the phone with him, and he said, you make sure that you give some. And so he said, this bag is for you, and this bag is for Larry. Larry already got his. This bag is for David, and this bag is for the group. And I said, oh, Swamiji, I can't even get them in my case. I know you're not supposed to turn down prasad. How about I take the one for David and for myself, and I will share them with Larry and the group. So he was talked out of it, but he wasn't too happy. I said to him afterwards, I hope you weren't offended. He said, no, I understand. So that's what they're like. So I'll give David over the prasad.
You have to be prepared for the prasad.
You have to leave a spot.
Could we
there?
Have hearing gnomes
yes.
At some point?
Yeah.
Oh, we can do that before we do this.
Let us stand for healing gnomes.